information all together. So they add sophistication to the concept, reinterpreting the anthropomorphic scriptural stories in a wide variety of non-literal ways that allow them to preserve belief. Even then, they often slip back into the old ways. Belief in answered prayer is one such anthropomorphic slip, since it would be contradictory for an all-wise and all-knowing God to change his mind because some of his unwise and ignorant creators, or creations rather, begged him to do so. Why should God be taking advice from us? He knows everything. Things like this show that it is the storybook God that provides the motivational engine behind the abstract God of theology, even though the two are totally different. So let's turn to theology. God is said to be omnipotent, meaning all-powerful, all-knowing, omnipresent, as in everywhere at once, all good, is unlimited, and a supreme being. But the problem with defining God in the abstract is that many of these abstractions make no sense or are unknowable. Thus, if God is a supreme being, he isn't merely superior to us, he is totally superior. The best there is now, ever was, and ever will be. Now, how could anyone know that? Confronting such a being, how would you know that this was the best that ever was and ever will be? You'd have to yourself know everything. So we can never know whether we have reached a supreme being. To the extent the abstractions might make some sense, they tend to contradict other abstractions that are also believed. Take the idea of God's omniscience. If God is all-knowing, he knows the future absolutely. He knows everything that will happen. And this means everything will happen as he knows it, which means he can't change anything. But if he can't change anything, he isn't all-powerful. Yet if he can change the future, then he isn't all-knowing. Both can't be true. Is that the end? Or do I have a second? In the face of the abstract God, they never briefed me on this, you know? They taught me all this stuff in Sunday school, but these guys didn't tell me about the bell. In the face of the abstract God of the theologians, then, the best response is agnosticism, where one declares that theology makes no sense, that we don't know what people are talking about when they talk about God. And therefore, there's nothing to say pro or con. God is just an incoherent concept, and it is certainly irrational to place belief in an incoherency.
Speech is now open to questions from the floor, which speakers are free to decline or accept. At 6 minutes, there's another bell, which means that they once again return to protected time. And at 7 minutes, there's a double bang to indicate them start finishing up. So that's the bell system. And now, moving on to start the case for the opposition, Dr. Angus Manoush.
I do think there is indeed good reason to believe in a personal God, and that we do know what we are talking about when we speak about God. Let me contrast Christian theism with humanism in a couple of areas. First of all, ethics. Mr. Edwards and other humanists claim that humanists support human flourishing, compassion and mercy, all these nice things. All without God, just based on human needs. Now, I don't deny that humanists can be moral without believing in God, but the question is whether the existence of moral values depends on the existence of God, and whether Christian teaching provides better support for Christian values than does humanism. And when we look at this, what we'll see is that humanism relies on borrowed capital in the area of ethics. Historically, as Alvin Schmidt has shown in a wonderful book, How Christianity Changed the World, the ancient pagan world had a very low value of human life. The individual was regarded as a value only if he was part of a political fabric and able to contribute to its uses. And so there was widespread child abandonment, exposure, dying geeks, deliberate infanticide, fleeing the sick, non-citizens could easily be executed for minor crimes. By contrast, Christianity teaches that human beings are made in the image of God and that no one is worthless for whom Christ died. That's fairly personal and fairly specific. And also, Schmidt points out that it was Christians who introduced the first general hospitals into the world, elevated status for women, they opposed slavery and corporate charity for the poor, and even for universal education. Secondly, when you look at this from a philosophical point of view, humanists who try to justify ethics without God always commit some version of a naturalistic fallacy, trying to get an ought from an is. If nature is all there is, then there's nothing special about humans. So why do humanists talk specifically about human interests? Why are they more valuable than the interests of other creatures? Isn't that speciesist to single out humans? And in fact, why should life be important? What about the value of rocks? Why not protect rocks from molestations of geologists? Fundamentally, nature is a realm of facts, not a realm of thoughts. And as the ethicist Richard Taylor has pointed out, in nature you'll see animals take food, you'll see them kill other animals, and you'll see them forcibly reproduce. But they don't steal, they don't murder, they don't rape. Alas, human beings do. So the source of moral obligation for human beings doesn't reside in nature, it comes from beyond nature. Now, why a personal rather than impersonal God? Well, because it's only persons who prescribe things. It is the doctor, not the medicine, who says take two, four times a day. Also, humanists never can agree among themselves as to what are the moral standards, and as a result, they try to impose one vision of human flourishing on everyone else. A good example, if you consider from 1923 to 2007, 76 million people were murdered in China under a humanist regime. Similarly large numbers in the USSR, okay, and Cambodia. I'd also like to add, this continues to this day. Okay, Roy Hansley, an atheist, admitted the response to the devastation of Hurricane Katrina was mostly by faith-based organizations, not by humanist ones. A second point I'd like to make. Humanists talk about the value of reason and say they don't need theology. Okay, well, but if nature is all there is and we are simply an assemblage of useful gadgets, okay, assembled by evolution, then there's no good reason to think that our minds are going to be reliable, especially in theoretical areas such as science and philosophy, and so no good reason to believe humanism or anything else. By contrast, if there is a God, and he is the architect of the laws in nature, and also we're made in his image, you would expect that our reason would be attuned to the reason in nature, and that we can discover scientific truth. And as a matter of historical fact, agreed to by most historians of science, the rise of modern science was made possible by Christian theology, not by materialism. See, for example, Peter Harrison's book, The Bible, Protestantism and the Rise of Modern Science. Kepler and Galileo, for example, said that nature was a book written in the language of mathematics. And Einstein, certainly no Christian, said that a priori, one should expect a chaotic world that doesn't make sense, and that it's a miracle to discover that elegant mathematical laws apply to the natural world. Why should beauty, mathematical beauty and elegance, be a guide to truth if this is not the work of a personal creator? So I think that we have excellent reason to say that there is a personal God. We can learn something from that God by his works in nature and from the character of the moral laws that he has provided. Have a different time. Okay, so in summation, The human disposition seems strong as long as you grant them reason and ethics. But what I would argue is that Christian theism is a much stronger foundation for reason and ethics than is humanism. Humanism, in fact, will undermine its own values and its own credibility. So there is excellent reason to believe in a God who is the foundation of rationality and ethics. Thank you.
At the end, there will be a questions and answers session where you can pose your questions to the guests. So, now to continue the case for the proposition, Mr. Stephen Boyle.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walter. Ladies and gentlemen, I think what Angus spoke about in his speech dealt with two of the major problems that I personally have with the arguments that are presented for God. I think in this debate, we can draw the distinction between saying that people can perfectly reasonably believe in a God for themselves, that that's reasonable on their own basis, and that it can provide them with a source of great personal solace and provide them with morality. That does not mean that that God exists. It's an argument for them believing in God based around the results of their belief, but not based around the reasons for their belief. And it's the reasons for that belief that I propose to examine during this speech. The first one that I want to look at, and I want to put it right, fore and centre, is this idea that we heard that the world is a beautiful place that is designed around mathematical rules. In essence, that the world is a complex place. The problem that I have with that argument is that it explains away complexity by saying our default position should therefore be that something more complex must have created that. That in itself is entirely contradictory, because it says, if the world is complicated, we need something to explain it. In order for God to have created that world, that God must, by its very nature, be more complicated in order to conceive of all those things. So that's the first idea that I want to get out right from the start. You can't explain away complexity by resorting to complexity. It simply doesn't stand up. I do disagree with people who believe in God, because I believe that there are better reasons, that there are better default positions, and that it's better sometimes to just say, we don't know. I can understand why a belief in God has evolved over the years. If you think about how man interacts with the world, we are tool-making people. We are people who create our own environment. So it is perfectly logical and rational for early man to look at himself and say, I can create all these things. Who created this world that seems to fit me perfectly? We rely then on the idea that the world was created to fit us rather than we slowly evolved to fit the world. I'll take you later on in the speech. What I look at is the idea that we cannot explain away God by resorting to gaps. If you look at God as something that is missing or some piece of knowledge that you cannot explain, you say you could not have humanist logic, you could not have ethics without God, and what you're saying is your default position is that God exists, rather than creating any particular argument in favour of that. We can see over history that relying on gaps has been a very, very dangerous ground for God to stand on. Because if you look at all the ideas in human history, we needed God to explain why the planets moved, why the earth rose in the morning, why the plants grew, why we interacted with each other, and over time we become able to explain more and more and more of those things away. If you rely on God as a gap, as something that's absent in logic, then there is always the danger that somebody will come along and discover something that will prove that to be untrue. So in order to say that you believe in God, you need not just an absence of knowledge about something, but you need to be able to say, I have positive evidence for the existence of God. That's not something that I have ever seen presented to me. Perhaps people will resort to the story of Doubting Thomas and say, well, he believed and he was right to do so and he got to see the evidence. Well, I think that was a story created to stop people asking questions. I think that the questions are the most important thing. It's asking why. Sometimes we won't know the answer, but if we hadn't asked why does the earth appear not to rotate around the sun, then we wouldn't know that our earth is not the centre of the universe. If Darwin hadn't asked why the earth and plants seem to follow a logical procession, why they have things that seem to be left over, then we wouldn't know that evolution exists. If we don't ask why now, did the Earth create itself? When you look at CERN and what we're trying to do there, ladies and gentlemen, then we would deny ourselves many opportunities for knowledge. Because if God is used to explain gaps, then by its nature, that resorts to saying, this is stuff that's God's domain, we shouldn't ask those questions. And I would always say that it's better for us to ask why, to ask that question, and that to sometimes say, we don't know, is a much better default position for ourselves. Not just because it leads to greater knowledge, but because we're not taking false solace from a God that we want to posit its existence just to explain away our own lack of knowledge. That's never evidence for God. It's just a question that has to be asked. I'll take your point now.
Well, I wasn't offering it now, Stephen, but sorry, just let me in. I'll have it on anyway. You say in the whole thesis that when we don't know, we should just admit to not knowing. If we honestly don't know, then how can we certainly say that God isn't as good an answer as any other answer?
Because the default position should always be, I'm unsure. The God hypothesis has been proven again and again and again to be inadequate to explain that lack of knowledge. We filled in those gaps. I conceive of God almost like a scaffolding. In the beginning, we needed God to explain many, many aspects of our own existence. We needed him to explain the day-to-day activities of the Earth because we couldn't understand them. Slowly, we built up the edifice of human knowledge, but we still needed to prop that up with God, because without that God, it all would have come tumbling down. We wouldn't have had enough knowledge to explain it. But as we filled in more and more bits of that knowledge, we came to realize that we didn't need God anymore. No, thank you. And evolution was the keystone that we placed in the top of that. If you're to labor the metaphor a little bit, if we were creating an arch with God's scaffold, then when we put in more knowledge, we realized that we could push Earth's existence and life's existence right back to the very, 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 very start of time, because we could explain everything from that point forward. So all that we're left with now as evidence for God in gaps is the idea that life is complicated, that at some point something must have come from nothing. That, I will admit, is a bewildering prospect to be faced with. It's something that we cannot explain at the moment. It's something that we may never be able to explain. But what I would urge you here today is to look at that as a challenge, to not fill that with the placeholding answer that we've had over time, but to ask why that happened. And if you look at the great history of human knowledge, the history of human progression, asking why has pushed back the boundary of God, and it has pushed forward the advancement of human intellect and human knowledge. So I would beseech this House to ask why. Thank you.
Opposition, Michael McGrath.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Alder, good evening. The issue of the existence of God is a very, very difficult issue to talk about. Firstly, because there are loads of different kinds of God. There's our God, who's deadly. He looks a lot like Gandalf, or possibly Dumbledore. He's pretty much the perfect father figure. He's understanding, he's loving, he's caring, and most importantly, he's richer than Bill Gates. There's then the much misunderstood Muslim God. There are the Hindu gods, the whole gang. And then there's the Jew God, who's a lot like our God, just without the love, the caring. Vengeful, badass kind of God. This is a God of locusts and rivers of blood. He's so angry that he turns people into pillars of salt. Like, that's so angry it doesn't even make sense. That he will smite thee into a pillar of not particularly useful combat. For he is a kick-ass god. There are, as the previous speaker said, unifying characteristics between these gods. Firstly, that they are some sort of divine consciousness. Secondly, that they are either omniscient or omnipotent or both. And finally, that the will of these gods is beyond our comprehension. These mere mortals, that we cannot comprehend the will of God, that you cannot understand God's mind, that our learned guests cannot understand God's mind, that even I, ladies and gentlemen, can't understand God's mind. I'm scared too, it's okay. Just a couple of things that were brought up in the last speaker's speech, Stephen's speech. Stephen said that, you know, God is going away as we explain things away. That, you know, we know the, how evolution works, and we know why the planets revolve. And no, they don't. We know how these things happen. We don't know exactly why they happen. That's why people believe in God. There's no Maxwell. I don't know what you're going to say, God isn't here now, but I'm pretty sure he was. He disagreed with you. This is the sort of reasoning, you know, that because we can explain things, that God doesn't exist. You know, people said years ago that, you know, we know why the Red Sea happened. I don't know what it was. It was something to do with, like, an earthquake and a tsunami or whatever. That, you know, that's how the Red Sea receded, and that's how Moses and all his followers passed through there. That's how it happened. We don't know why it happened at that specific time. So basically we're talking about here science versus religion, and I use the term science very, very loosely, because it's what I'm talking about is a system of thinking that proceeds only on the fact, only on the knowledge of things that we know, only on the knowledge of things that we have evidence for their existence. The proposition has said that logic dictates that God cannot exist because we have no proof that he exists. When we say that's flawed logic, I say that's flawed logic. What's really rational is that until we have proven or disproven the existence of something, it's kind of irrational to completely rule out the fact that it might exist. It's foolish to just discount the possibility of its existence. Easter Bunny. Well, very few people here actually believe that Easter Bunny exists. Unlike God. As Jules Verne said, we shouldn't shrug our shoulders so readily. But then again, Jules Verne did say a lot of things. Basically, what the proposition are trying to say, they're trying to get you to assume that because logic and science don't say that God exists, that God doesn't exist. And that's not true at all. Science doesn't tell us either way whether or not God exists. Logic is completely mute on the issue. Because we have any proof that God doesn't exist, we have no proof possibly that he does exist. So we're pretty much even on both sides of the debate. Stephen said in his last speech, that the default position should be that I'm unsure, that we should always say I'm unsure. Yeah, well, by that logic, I'm kind of unsure that God doesn't exist. There's no proof either way. So why are we so quick to assume that science has ruled out the existence of God? I think this is a very dangerous position. It's a very, very dangerous. It's like playing with fire. Well, it's not really that dangerous. It's kind of like boiling a kettle with just a little bit of water in it. The danger of this viewpoint is that people believe that science doesn't really have to evolve by questioning and theorizing, that science can just say, no, I'm unsure, so that's okay for me. The danger is probably best illustrated by Richard Dawkins, by the fact that his publications say that scientifically God does not exist. That's not true, ladies and gentlemen. Science on the issue of God has become dogmatic, has become an anti-religion. Science now is settled in the face of religion, where it really shouldn't be. Science should never be biased to the point of exclusion of things that might exist, and science should certainly never be as automatic as it is. Yeah.
You said that the reason why we should believe or attempt to believe in God is because we don't understand why all of this stuff happens. Why does that necessarily have to have a purpose?
It doesn't. It doesn't us. But why does it necessarily not have to have a purpose? That's the point that I'm making. The point I'm making is that science may never get to the end of this. I'd like to believe it does. I'd like to see proof one way or the other that God does or does not exist. But the thing is, maybe we can never fully understand that God exists. As I said, you know, one of the key characteristics of God is that we'll never understand his mind. Maybe it's like asking a two-dimensional person a 3D question. Maybe it's like asking an art student, what are your career prospects? Prostitutes say that because we don't have any evidence, there's no way it should be believed. Well, what I'm saying is that before we need proof, before we have proof of anything, anything at all, including God, you have to have a theory, and you have to have supporters of that theory. So like there were supporters of the theories of genetics and computer power and steam engines, you have supporters in religions of the idea of a God. This debate kind of comes down to the fact that until you have proof or evidence against something, I think it's perfectly rational to believe either way. And I challenge the proposition to say anything to that. So I beg to oppose.
Well, adjusting the recorder, I will talk quite slowly, and we're done. And so now to continue on the debate, Mr. Sean Carroll.
How can I possibly follow that? I'd like to thank the Society for inviting me here. This is my first trip to Ireland, and for the first time in my life, I know now how to correctly spell my own first name. I'm a professional cosmologist. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I believe that my purpose here is to help explain why you don't need God to understand the universe. There are people who argue in favor of the existence of God by saying that God serves a purpose in helping us to explain the existence of the entire universe. And these arguments are not very good. They come in a couple of different varieties. One variety is to say, well, the universe needed to have a creator. You could argue that a priori. You could say, look, the Big Bang, science has taught us that the universe came into existence at a moment 14 billion years ago. And the truth is that it seems to be the case that our observable patch of universe that we live in came into existence 14 billion years ago, but we do not know what happened before that. We don't know why that happened, but that is not to say that we can't know why it happened. It is a myth to say that before the Big Bang there was no such thing as space or time. It could be true that that is the case, but is it not true that we know that to be the case on the basis of current cosmology? People are working very hard on theories in which space and time existed before the Big Bang, that there was an event describable by the laws of physics according to which our universe was created. The point is that the creation of the universe is exactly in the category of things that Stephen already talked about, things where we used to say, well, that doesn't make any sense to us, it must be God's fault. But as we push forward, science is learning how to understand these questions, whether it be why things move in the universe, why life evolved, or why the universe came into existence. The other argument people sometimes make is that in order to explain the fact that the universe exists, you need to invoke the existence of God. There's what Adolf Grunbaum calls the primordial existential question. Why is there something rather than nothing? And you can look up this question in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Why is there something rather than nothing? And it says, why not? And that is the correct answer, actually, as it turns out. We're used to things in the world that we can touch and make, and we see some things, not others, and we say, well, there must be a reason why this thing exists. But when it comes to everything, when it comes to the entire universe in which we live, we don't need an explanation for why that everything exists. It could very well be that the universe's existence requires no explanation. The point is that adding God to your story of the universe, to say that God is the explanation for the universe, doesn't help you in any way. It does not make the story simpler. It does not increase your understanding. It does not increase our ability to say new things about the universe. Then you just ask, why does God exist? And they say, well, God is the being that necessarily exists. I define God to be something that exists, therefore I don't have to answer that question. This is also not helpful. The point is that at some level in the chain of explanations, from things we observe every day to the universe itself, we're going to come to a bottom. And the bottom might involve the laws of physics and the existence of the universe, and that might be it. That's not something to be sad about. That's something to accept, to understand that that is the universe which we understand. But I also want to say that none of this matters. It matters to cosmologists or to theologians or to philosophers. People like to debate about these things. Why is there something rather than nothing? But it has never changed the mind of any person who is concerned about whether or not God exists. All the philosophical debates in the world are interesting but not really determinative when it comes to people's opinions. They first form the opinion and then they choose which philosophical side of the debate they would like to be on. I once taught a course at the University of Chicago on the history of atheism. And we were not proselytizing. There were people in the class who were religious and non-religious and so forth. And we talked all about all the different proofs and arguments for and against the existence of God, and no one cared. It didn't matter what their personal beliefs were. They were happy to argue about them. But when we talked about how the Bible came to be written, when we mentioned the historical and archaeological evidence that says, actually, it's not true that the people who were Jesus' apostles wrote the Gospels, or Genesis was written by Moses. In fact, you can look at Genesis and see how it was written from different texts that were stitched together by an editor who was not very careful. People got upset. That they didn't like. When you talk about the actions of how religion plays itself out in the world, that changes people's minds. When my wife Jennifer and I arrived here in Dublin yesterday, we took a cab ride from the airport to the hotel, and we had a cab driver who says, "Well, why are you here in Dublin?" I'm thinking, should I tell anyone? And I decided to go with the truth, you know, when in doubt. So I explained, there's going to be a debate. He said, what is it going to be a debate about? And I explained what it's going to be about. And he said, and which side are you on? And I told him which side I was on, that God does not exist. And so he thought about that, and he said, well, what about love? And I said, well, I love my wife, so there. I mean, I can insist whether or not God is not helping me with this. And he thought about it, he said, you know, Ireland over the last 10, 20 years has become increasingly a very secular country. And actually, I didn't know that. I mean, Ireland, the stereotype from people in the United States is that Ireland is a quite Catholic religious country. He says, it's beginning to fade away, so says my taxi driver anyway. And so we said, why? And he said, well, it's because of the decay of the moral authority of the church. That the high peak was 1979, the Pope came to visit, and a third or a quarter of the population of Ireland came to visit the Pope, and that was, everyone was really happy about that. But since then, it's been an increasing story of too many women having to take trains to Northern Ireland to buy condoms and being arrested on their way back, too many priests getting in trouble for this or that, and that has greatly eroded people's belief in the church. And the point is that you might say, well, this is a set of emotional appeals. What does that mean? 1 minute left. You might say this is a set of emotional appeals. They should be discarded when it comes to our deep and rational philosophical understandings of whether or not God exists. But I don't think that's true. I think that, in fact, these people who are not paying attention to the primordial existential question, but are paying attention to the behavior of people who are religious and not religious, have a point. The point is that the world in which we live, the physical universe, the natural universe, as well as the social milieu in which we're embedded, is exactly what it would be if God did not exist. If God did not exist, we would have a universe that obeys the laws of physics just like it does. If God did not exist, we would have human beings that would be religious, we would have a Bible, we would have priests, we would have the whole ball of wax. Because people like that. People like authority, and they like understanding, they like to feel that they are somehow important to the universe as a whole. And it would also be the case that among those priests, some of them were really, really good people, and some of them were not so good people. The point is, the world that we see around us, including belief in religion and including everything we know, both scientifically and philosophically, says that from a rational point of view, we should not believe in the existence of God. If God existed, Sarah Palin would not be an important political figure of our time. American on the panel, I just want to say we're sorry.
To continue the case for the opposition, Dr. Alistair Noble. The whole frame of nature bespeaks an intelligent author. Think about that for a moment. And it continues, and no rational inquirer can, after serious reflection, suspend his belief a moment with regard to the primary principles of genuine theism and religion. Now, surprisingly, that was said by David Hume. Perhaps the only merit I see in Hume is that he was Scottish. But Hume, whose work is generally regarded as demolishing the design inference in nature, Nevertheless, recognize that ultimate question. And that's what I'd like to direct your attention to. I want to ask you to reflect on the I word in the motion, that it is irrational to believe in God. I don't seem to need to prove that God exists, but I do have to convince you that it is not irrational so to do. Well, it seems that not only is Hume in the camp of the alleged fantasists, but a good number of the architects of modern science are there as well, like Galileo, Newton, Faraday, Pascal, Kelvin, and others, who broadly held in their scientific work that they were exploring the works of a great creator. A significant number of scientists today, including, for example, the distinguished Francis Collins of the Human Genome Project, feels the same way. And I personally find it hard to believe that all of these individuals did their brilliant work in science while caught up in a spasm of irrationality. I also find it interesting that Sean Carroll, who proposes a motion which effectively equates rationalism with materialism, is himself, if he doesn't mind me saying so, a man of a certain degree of faith. But let me explain what I mean. Listening to what he said tonight, I compare it with what I read of a paper that he delivered to the Russian Anglo-American Conference on Cosmology and Theology in 2005, and he outlined his position like this. The materialist thesis is simply, that's all there is to the world. Once we have figured out the correct formal structures, patterns, boundary conditions, and interpretation, we have obtained a complete description of reality. And he then adds, of course, we don't have the final answers, something that he's already said to us this evening, as to what such a description is. But a materialist believes, and these are crucial words, a materialist believes that such a description does exist. Now, that's rather different from saying we don't know. It is really saying we will someday know. Now, I suggest that that is a statement of a kind of faith in a philosophical or worldview position, rather than a position that is securely established by scientific investigation. Until the evidence is beyond all reasonable doubt, you cannot dismiss a theistic view of the universe as irrational. You may not accept it, but you cannot dismiss it as irrational. And indeed, Professor Carroll doesn't do that. In the same paper to which I've referred, he says, in my view, neither materialism nor theism is logically impossible. If theism is logically possible, it can't be at the same time irrational. Now, I'd like to focus on some of the scientific evidence, which I think certainly provides a basis for theistic belief.
Point.
I would rather continue, thank you. And I'm going to use, if I may, one or two I words to match the irrational word in the motion. The first word is the word intelligibility. I think we've done it a little injustice tonight. Einstein said that the most comprehensible thing about the universe is that it is so comprehensible. And Professor John Lennox at Oxford, in his recent book, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God?, points out that the very concept of the intelligibility of the universe presupposes the existence of a rationality capable of recognizing that intelligibility. And I suggest to you that it is the capacity to perceive the rational intelligibility of the universe that has justifiably led generations of thinkers to conclude that the universe itself must be the product of intelligence. Philosopher Keith Ward has it that to the majority of people who have reflected deeply about the origin and the nature of the universe, it has seemed that it points beyond itself to a source which is non-physical, a source of great intelligence and power. Now, you may not accept that, but I submit to you that you cannot dismiss it as an irrational proposition. I think related to this is the much debated observation that the physical constants of the universe appear to be finely tuned in a way that makes our planet fit for life, So much so that Professor Fred Hoyle suggested on one occasion that it did look as if someone had monkeyed, some intelligence had monkeyed with the physics of the universe to achieve this. I'd rather make my point so we can discuss yours later. The popular alternative to this argument of fine-tuning is to postulate that we live in a multiverse, and our universe just happens to be the one that has the right values for life as we know it. Now, I submit to you that that's a classic example of where the speculative is preferred over the inference to the best explanation. We actually have finely tuned physical constants in our universe. We don't know if we have a multiverse. And I think I'd like to give a word to Professor Anthony Flew, the lifelong atheist who has recently embraced the design argument. Multiverse or not, he says, we still have to come to terms with the laws of nature. And the only viable explanation, and this is an astonishing confession from a former atheist, is the divine mind. How much time do I have left?
Approximately 45 seconds.
45 seconds. I wanted to talk about the intricacy of molecular and living systems, and talk about Michael Behe, the American biochemist. Perhaps I should pause for the booze, but I think I'm going to skip that section and come to the third point I wanted to make, which is about information. It is clear in our world that there is a huge information content in living things, particularly in the molecule of DNA. The enduring mystery of modern biology is the origin of that information content. In all our experience, information only arises from prior intelligence. And the question I have is, why is it different in nature? Why should it be considered irrational to extrapolate from all our experience and to conclude that there will someday be an explanation of the information that appears to be front-loaded into the universe? I oppose the motion this evening by saying to you, it is certainly not irrational to believe that there is behind our universe an intelligent causation. You may not agree, but whatever my position is, I submit to you, it is not an irrational position. And for that reason, I urge you to vote against the motion. I beg to oppose.
We continue on the case for the proposition, Ms. Ivanovic. I would like to remind the audience that this is Ivan's maiden speech, so no hair.